All glories to you, because on your brilliant white body, you wear garments the color of a fresh blue rain cloud. These garments are also the same beautiful dark hue of the Yamuna, who is greatly fearful due to the striking of your plow. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
August 20th, 2013, the appearance day of Lord Balaram in Hilo, Hawaii, and we're going to be reading Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 68. So, the verse we were singing from Das Avatar is about Lord Balaram doing what?
Using his plow
to pull the Yamuna to him. And this chapter is about Lord Balaram using his plow to pull
Hastinapur
to the Ganga.
Mm.
This is a good chapter to read if you don't want to be pulled into the Ganga by the plow. If you want to jump in of your own volition and swim voluntarily. So we're going to go through the chapter. It's a fairly short chapter. Only about 54 verses. Sukadeva Goswami said, O King, Jambavati's son, named Samba, ever victorious in battle, kidnapped Duryodhana's daughter, what was her name?
Lakshmana,
from her Swayamvara ceremony. So in the Swayamvara ceremony, the princess is supposed to be able to pick her own husband. Swam means your own. You can pick your own husband. He said, nope, I'm taking you. Was that very nice?
No.
No, it wasn't. She didn't like it very much. And her relatives didn't like it either. The angry Kuru said, this ill-behaved boy has offended us, forcibly kidnapping our unmarried daughter against her will. So there was a mood in those days of protecting the ladies, not letting somebody kidnap the women against their will, especially the qualified girls. Their own desires were very much respected. It's not that, oh, you have to do this, you have to do that. Who do you want to marry? So they were very angry at Samba. Arrest this ill-behaved Samba. What will the Rishnis do? Now, this was their problem. This started their problem. And they started to become arrogant at the family of God. What will the Rishnis do? By our grace, they are ruling land that we have granted them. Uh-oh. This is a problem. So just like in our homes, everybody have an altar in their house or their room? Yes? Okay. Do you think, oh, I have graciously granted this altar space to God out of my great benevolence? Generally, even religious people think like that. You have to remember, the Kurus were not demons. So generally, even religious people think like that. They think, well, my time belongs to me. Isn't that silly? Anybody here create time? No. But we think my time is mine to do with as I please. My resources are mine. Hunt unfortunately, I have to pay a tax on my time to my employer. And out of my great goodness and generosity, I give God some of my time. That's what most people think, even religious people think like that. They think I'm such a benevolent person that I give God a little of my time. I give God a little space in my house. I give God a little space in my life. So the Kurus took this to another level, and they said, by our grace, we have let the Yadus rule. Now, if you know the history, you know that Yadu wasn't allowed to rule. You all know the back history of that? Right? And King Yayati was cursed to become old. He had children by his wife and by his legally married wife and by his common-law wife, Ashramista. And when he wanted to exchange his old age for their youth, he asked Yadu, and Yadu said no. Now, Yadu said no for a good reason. You know what was Yadu's reason for saying no?
He wanted to be devotional.
He wanted to be devotional, so why would it matter?
Well, he would be entangled in old age.
He'd be entangled in old age, but why did he want to be youthful when he was meant to be youthful?
Is Krishna always going to take birth in his 90s?
Oh, well, that's interesting, yes, because Krishna was going to take birth in his dynasty, so he had to have children. But it was also, it's explained by the Acharyas, that he understood that it would be very difficult to properly renounce unless he first been a grihastha. That if he just, boom, went to old age, he probably wouldn't make it. And he wouldn't be a suitable servitor of the Lord. So, you know, in some of the sampradayas, they really practice giving sannyas to children. But first of all, they have very few sannyasis. And they look, the madhvas, they give sannyas to children who haven't gone through the ashrams. But they have hardly any sannyasis. And they don't let them travel and preach. They protect them with big walls around them, practically speaking. Right? And the Sri Vaishnavas, they very rarely give sannyas to someone who hasn't gone through all of the ashramas. So Yadu was saying, you know, I've got to go through the ashramas. If I just become all of a sudden an old man, I'm not going to make it. So Yayati wasn't so pleased with that. He said, okay, you're not going to rule. You're not going to inherit the kingdom because you disobeyed me. So therefore, the Yadus don't become the main rulers of the earth. So the Kurus had this mood that whatever rule you have, it's because of us, because of our kindness to you. So that was their mood here. If the Vrishnis come here, when they will learn that their son has been captured, we will break their pride. Now, of course, just the opposite is going to happen. Thus they'll become subdued. Again, just the opposite happens. Like bodily senses brought under strict control. So this is also the mentality, unfortunately, of even most religious people. They're trying to control God. Okay, God, let's see. I've done this austerity, and I followed this rule, and I've done, now give me this. I want this, and I want this, and I want this, and I want this. Isn't that the mood of most religious people? And when you get what you want, yes, there's a God. Right? Okay, I've been a good person. Please cure my Aunt Sally. She's cured. Yes, yes. And they write about it in their magazines and so forth. Yeah. So that's the mood here of the Kurus, that God should be doing what we want, that we've given him the space. After saying this, and having their plan sanctioned by the senior member of the Kuru dynasty. Who is the senior member of the Kuru dynasty? Bhishma. Now, Bhishma actually went with the Kurus with this plan. Karna, Shala, Buri, Yagnaketu, and Suyodhana set out to attack Samba. Now, it's explained that what they also wanted to do, they didn't just want to attack Samba, because when they went to Bhishma, Bhishma said, you know, Samba's kidnapped her, it's over. She's not going to marry anybody else. Now, in our modern society, we probably consider this absolutely absurd. You know, wait a minute, she doesn't love him just because he kidnapped her. It's not her fault. Big deal. She shouldn't have to marry him. And in fact, the 16,100 queens that were kidnapped by Bulbasaur, they all were married by Krishna. But why do you think they had this sort of rule in their society? How did it benefit people? Any idea? The once a boy and girl were together, they had to get married.
Something good reputation.
Yeah, okay, about reputation. But also what else?
Guilt.
Because
the first cut is the deepest.
That's also true. Your first attachment really stays. Yes?
Unwanted population.
To curb unwanted population. Also to make people responsible. To say to the guy, you know, you mess with the girl, you got to marry her. That's it. You can't say, well, I'm just going to mess with her and go away. It forced people to be responsible, and it meant that there wasn't much illicit sex in society. So today, where we've relaxed all these sort of stigmas, oh, you know, we don't want to stigmatize this person or that person, or this, then we end up having a very chaotic society. Seeing Duryodhana and his companions rushing toward him, Sambha, the great chariot fighter, took up his splendid bow and stood alone like a lion. So another reason the Kurus went to capture Sambha is they wanted to check him out. Okay, you've taken Lakshmana, are you really a worthy Kshatriya? Because to marry the prince, he had to be a prince. He couldn't be just some kind of a wimp. They wanted to see, was he a real fighter? Determined to capture him, the angry bowman led by Karna shouted at Sambha, stand and fight, stand and fight! So the real Kshatriyas, they don't shoot anybody in the back. They always say, beware! Right? At the modern age, everybody shoots everybody in the back, isn't it? Even your friends shoot you in the back. But in those days, even your enemies, they would meet you face to face. And they'd give you warning. I'm going to fight. I'm going to fight. Prepare. Prepare. They came straight for him and showered him with arrows. Oh, best of the Kurus, as Krishna's son Sambha was being unjustly harassed by the Kurus, unjustly because you're supposed to only fight one to one. That darling of the Yadu dynasty did not tolerate their attack any more than a lion would tolerate an attack by puny animals. Twanging his wonderful bow, heroic Sambha struck with arrows the six warriors headed by Karna. He pierced the six chariots with as many arrows, each team of four horses with four arrows, and each chariot driver with a single arrow, and he similarly struck the great bowman who commanded the chariots. The enemy warriors congratulated Sambha for this display of prowess. So again, it wasn't actually enmity, but they were testing him, and they were, yes, well done, well done, well done. And it's interesting that Sambha didn't just sit there and cry, it's unfair, right? He didn't say, well, I'm not going to fight you, too many. He said, okay, you guys are going to be unfair, still I'm going to do the right thing. So many times in life, we're in circumstances that are unfair, yes? It doesn't just happen to me, yes? And do we sit down and cry, or do we stand and fight and say, okay, I'm going to do the right thing. I'm never mind the other party is unrighteous, I'm going to be righteous. So many times we use other people's unrighteousness as an excuse for our unrighteousness. Well, they're acting improperly, so I'm justified with acting improperly. But some is here, you're acting improperly, okay, but I'm going to do the right thing. I'm not going to walk away. And he showed that he was able to defeat all of them. But they forced him down from his chariot, and thereupon four of them struck his four horses. So he struck the four horses of all of them, but it took four of them to strike his four horses. One of them struck down his chariot driver, and another broke his bow. Having deprived Sambha of his chariot during the fight, the crew of warriors tied him up with great difficulty and then returned victorious to their city, taking the young boy and their princess. Now, I'm not quite sure what they had in mind. So none of the acharyas comment on quite what they intended. Of course, they did say in the beginning they expected the Rishnis to come. So it was basically a challenge. But they certainly weren't going to keep their own daughter just in the palace, you know, with her now soon-to-be husband tied up for a long time. Okay, when the Yadavas heard news of this from Sri Narada, so they didn't have phones or telegraphs or the internet, but they had Narada Muni. Which would be a much nicer way to hear the news, wouldn't it? They became angry. And why did they become angry? So sometimes we think that in spiritual life, there's no anger. The impersonalists like to preach like this, that everyone is just... For forever, huh? Is that attractive? Would you all like to just be just like that forever?
No way.
Peace. Love. That'd be boring, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So anger is one of the rasas. Anger is one of the secondary rasas. We're going to see here how this anger, Balaram, is beneficial. The main lesson here in this story is Balaram is the benefactor. Balaram is beneficial. The Lord is beneficial. The Lord is the benefactor. That the Lord never does anything except to benefit the living entities. Everything that Balaram does is for benediction and bliss. So the Yadus became angry, but this anger wasn't like ordinary anger. Material anger is, I have my desires for my own sense enjoyment. They get frustrated, and therefore I get angry. That's material anger is like that. Material anger is I want something and I can't get it, I become angry. I want something, I get it, and I don't like it, I become angry. I want something, I get it, I love it, I lose it, I become angry. Or I'm afraid I'm going to lose it. And you can see, if you examine your own material, probably none of you experience material anger, but if you do experience any material anger, if you look under it, you'll see there's a fear. There's a fear, I won't get what I want, or I won't be happy with what I get, or I'm going to lose something that I have. It's ironic, of course, that we tend to be very angry with the people that we care about the most. Because those are the people we think we're really depending on to get our sense gratification. So if we think, you know, they might not keep giving me what I need, then those are the people we tend to get angry with. But anger and transcendence is very different. It's an anger of love. It's an anger of giving. And we'll see this as the story unfolds. So they became angry. Urged on by King Ugrasena, they prepared for war against the Kuru. So this is often the result of anger, that you just immediately become angry and you're ready to go to war. Isn't it? You don't stop to hear the other side. You don't think about it. You don't try for peace. Just war. Lord Balaram, however, cooled the tempers of the Vrishni heroes who had already put on their armor. Now that's pretty clever. It's hard to cool someone's temper when they've already got their armor on. But Balaram is quite a peacemaker. He tries, of course, for the whole battle of Kurukshetra to make peace. He doesn't even engage in the battle himself. He who purifies the age of quarrel did not want a quarrel between the Kurus and Vishnus. And in the Sanskrit it says Kali and Kali. Kali for the age of Kali and Kali for meaning quarrel. So in this age of Kali, we quarrel, my dear friends, just to quarrel. People in this age quarrel for no reason or for insignificant reasons. So a friend of mine said recently how he overheard a couple having practically a knockdown, drag-out fight about when their bank closed on Saturday. All you have to do is call the bank, you know. The people are having knockdown, drag-out fights. Sometimes fights that go on for decades just to fight. And it's like Prabhupada talked about the scientists doing the rock, paper, scissors, you know, and they're drowning and they're still fighting with the rock, paper, scissors. So this fighting just because I have to be right, doesn't matter what it's about. It can be about when the bank closes, you know. It could be about what color somebody's dog is. It doesn't matter what it's about. I have to be right and you have to be wrong. Somehow I have to be right and you have to be wrong. So one of my friends posted something today about how in the Narada Bhakti Sutra, vada, or argument for the sake of argument, is forbidden to bhaktas. That one should not engage in argument just for the sake of argument. And it goes on and on and on, doesn't it? I'm right, no I'm right, no I'm right, no I'm right, no I'm right. And sometimes it can seem like it's part of bhakti, you know, because you're pulling out your shlokas and they're pulling out their shlokas and you're pulling out your authorities and they're pulling out their authorities and you're saying the world's going to end and they're saying the world's going to end. But really, the only reason we're arguing is because we're in the age of argument. And there's not really any other reason besides that. So Balaram didn't want the devotees to quarrel in the age of quarrel. He may be the age of quarrel, but he wanted the devotees to be on a different platform. Thus, accompanied by brahmanas and family elders, he went to Hastinapur on his chariot, which was as effulgent as the sun. As he went, he appeared like the moon surrounded by the lunar planet. So this kind of description of the Lord is frequent in the Bhagavatam, that he looks like the moon. Ramachandra, when he returns after his exile, is also compared to the moon surrounded by the stars and the planets, or the sun surrounded by the planets. Upon arriving in Hastinapur, Lord Balaram remained in a garden outside the city and sent Uddhava ahead to probe King Dhritarashtra's intentions. Who else came to a city and stayed outside the garden and didn't go in? When else in the Bhagavatam does this happen? Did it happen?
I was thinking Sita, but no.
No, that was a little different.
In the Bhagavatam.
What other instance do we have of somebody who stayed in a garden outside the city? Did you come in?
Bharat Maharaj, when he ruled the Mayodhya.
Oh, yeah, he did. But that was a little different. He wasn't going for battle. He was staying outside because he didn't want to say that he was the king. He wanted to say that Ram was the king. Thank you. That was a good one. No, Hanuman went right into Lanka. Burned it.
Dwarka. He stayed in the garden at Dwarka. Had a little battle with
Baladeva. Ah, I don't know that story.
Oh, Arjuna, when he pretended that he was a sannyasi, he lived outside the city to get a room.
He didn't go to fight.
He's got a fight.
Who went to fight, but he stayed in a garden outside the city?
Krishna, when he fought the demon with the 17 heads or arms.
Oh, with the Mura demon? No, he broke the barrier. Okay, it also includes Balaram. Balaram and...
Oh, you got us.
Come on, guys. Okay. Krishna and Balaram! Where did they go to fight? Where they stayed outside the city. They went to a garden. They didn't go in the city. They camped in a garden, Krishna and Balaram.
Kamsa!
When they were going to kill Kamsa, they camped in a garden outside the city. I mean, they came into the city to fight, but they camped in a garden. Any idea why Balaram's going to be camping outside of Hastinapur? Yeah. Why he's not going to go into Hastinapur?
Quick getaway.
Quick getaway. Okay, to understand this, we have to understand a little bit of the etiquette of the time, which to us right now may seem really, really weird. So the etiquette at that time is the junior has to come to see the senior. If somebody comes to see you, that's indicative of their status. So again, this doesn't make sense to us. In our modern families, you know, your mother says, "Hey, kid, come here." And the kid says, "What?" He doesn't do anything. Yes? Isn't it? The mother and father has to go see the kid. The kid doesn't go to the parents. So we don't quite get this. So there's an interesting story in the Bible that illustrates this principle. Any of you familiar with the Book of Esther? You familiar with the Book of Esther? So the king, Ahasuerus, he had banished, in a drunken stupor, he had banished his wife, what was her name? Something with Vashti, because she wouldn't appear naked in front of all of his counselors when he was drunk. You know, she said, "I'm not going to come naked, my husband's drunk." So he banished her, and then he had no queen. So then there was a call for all of the women in the kingdom who wanted to marry the king to come and prepare themselves, and he picked Esther to be his queen. And then Esther was from the Jewish community, and she was told by her cousin that one of the king's advisors was planning on killing all the Jews, and he said, "You had better talk to your husband, the king, and see what you can do to avert this calamity." But the rule was that unless the king called for you, you couldn't come. So even though she was the queen, even though she was the wife, if she had entered her husband's quarters without him calling for her first, she could be killed. She could be executed. So because it was an emergency, what she did was she fasted and prayed for 3 days. And then she entered his chamber without an invitation, and he extended his scepter to her, saying that he welcomed her, and therefore she was allowed in. Of course, eventually she saved the day and so forth, and she's the heroine and has a book in the Bible named after her. But the point is, there was an etiquette that the junior has to go to see the senior. The senior doesn't go to see the junior. And again, in our modern society, especially in America, so America is the second most egalitarian culture in the world. Do you know what the most is? Australia. So Australia is the most egalitarian culture in the world, the most, the least class conscious, the least hierarchical conscious. After that is America, very much up there as a country like Sweden. And then there are countries that are very hierarchical. India, of course, I think Bolivia is near the top. Korea is very close to the top. There was a situation some years ago where one of the main Korean airlines had one of the worst accident records in the world. And investigating, they found out that the accidents always happened when the pilot was flying and the co-pilot noticed a problem. Because the co-pilot didn't feel that it was his place to bring the problem to the attention of the pilot, who was his superior. So he would just sort of hint at it, like, you know, there might, I'm thinking you might want to look over there on our left, that sort of thing. And so when they finally figured out what the problem was and they brought in advisors, one of the things they did was force all the Korean pilots to learn English. Because in Korean, there's like 10 or 15 different ways of saying you, depending on status. Like in Hindi, there's two different yous. And by learning English, only one kind of you, just learning the language, changed their culture somewhat. And they had to teach them that, wait a minute, you know, the co-pilot has just as much right to say something as the pilot. So again, we may not get this kind of thing. I was just recently dealing with a project in India that I'm very involved with. And there was some conflict between the management and some of the workers there. And one of the workers wrote an email and said, well, at least so-and-so, who was the head of the project, at least so-and-so has now apologized for what he did. So the second in charge of management was talking to me on the phone and just livid with rage and says, how does anyone dare suggest that the head of the project ever has to apologize to anybody ever for anything? And he started crying. He said, I would rather die than see my boss ever have to apologize. And I was like, wow. So by Balaram staying outside the city, what had to happen?
They had to come see him.
They had to deal with the fact that he's in a superior position. Okay, so on arriving in Hastinapur, Lord Balaram remained in a garden outside the city and sent Uddhava ahead to probe King Dhritarashtra's intention. So he sends somebody into the city, but he stays outside. After he had offered proper respects to the son of Ambika, Dhritarashtra, and this is a little reminder by saying the son of Ambika, that Dhritarashtra is not the blood heir. There's all these little hints sometime in their dealings. And Bhishma, Drona, Balika, and Duryodhana, and Uddhava informed them that Lord Balaram had arrived. They noticed that the Pandavas are not mentioned in this list. That's because the Acharyas tell us the Pandavas are already in Indraprastha at this time. Overjoyed. Now, they're overjoyed to hear that Balaram, their dear most friend, had come. So why do Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra see that Balaram is their dearmost friend?
Because he was a peacemaker?
He was a peacemaker, yeah.
Also because Balaram had taught Duryodhana how to fight. And so he was really dear to the Kauravas.
Yes. Now it's interesting here, and this is really sort of the crux of this story, that the Kauravas see Balaram as dear to them when he does what they like. And when he doesn't do what they like, he's not dear to them anymore. They don't understand that Balaram is the benefactor. They don't understand that Balaram is the benefactor, that Balaram is the dear friend, that Bhagavan is always our benefactor. Although they're religious people, it's not that they're not demons. I mean, in a sense, you could say Duryodhana is a demon, but they were righteous people. They were following the rules of Vedic culture. But the mood was, God's there as my servant. He's there to do what I like. Oh, here's Balaram, who gives me what I like. Oh, I'm so happy to see him.
You call him as God?
He's referred to in the verses as Bhagavan, but at least they understood this is someone who's our benefactor. I'm sure some of them saw him as God and some of them not. Overjoyed to hear that Balaram, thank you, their dearmost friend had come. They first honored Uddhava and then went forth to meet the Lord carrying auspicious offerings in their hands. Now this is also significant of status. It's stated that when everyone goes to see God or a saintly person, one is supposed to bring an offering. Again, most of us don't do this. This is something you see among the Indian population. So when the Indians come to any temple, they always bring some donation, something. They bring some money, they bring a bag of rice. At Bhaktivedanta Manor in London, there's so much bhoga donated for the deities that the managers, about maybe every 2 weeks, load up a big van with all the extra bhoga and drive it to other temples in Europe because they can't even use all of it. And they're giving out 3 free meals a day to anybody who comes. So just imagine how much is being donated. So that's the mood, that whenever you go to see God or a saintly person, you're not supposed to go empty-handed. So, but here we see that Balaram's not sending gifts to the Kurus. The Kurus are sending gifts to Balaram. So again, we see something here about status. Who's higher? I remember when I was growing up, if we would visit someone's home, we'd always bring a gift. And again, it's not done so much anymore. Now we hardly even say hello to people anymore. We don't even write out the whole words. Okay, now the next is they. Now this includes the elders like Bhishma. They approached Lord Balaram and worshipped him with gifts of cows and argya as was fitting. Those amongst the Kurus who understood his true power bowed down to him, touching their heads to the ground. So here's your point. So some of them understood they were dealing with God and some didn't. After both parties had heard that their relatives were doing well and both had inquired into each other's welfare and health, Lord Balaram forthrightly spoke to the Kurus as follows. So first they made some small talk. It's interesting to me that whenever anyone prays to Krishna, they always first offer some sort of glorification as well. They don't get right to the point kind of thing. Even we're studying in our Sripe classes about Uchira, going to the Lord and asking for protection. And she was in immediate danger, and still she has one verse where she just glorifies him. And then she says, okay, please help me. And when Arjuna is counteracting the Brahmastra, he also goes through all of these verses, glorifying the Lord, even though he's in immediate danger. So again, in our modern society, we tend to, especially in America, we tend to like, just get to the point, right? Cut the niceties. But in a civilized society, there was always some niceties and some etiquette. Lord Balaram said, now interesting, who's the king in Dwarka?
Ugrasena.
It's also fascinating about God, because we worship...
In Mathura, Ugrasena.
But Mathura and in Dwarka also. Ugrasena. After they moved. Yeah, they moved Ugrasena with them. So it's also fascinating to me that, in general, God is called the King of Kings. But we see that Krishna and Balaram are the princes. They're not the kings. In Dwarka, Ugrasena is the king, and in Vrindavan, Nandamaraj is the king. Because we're seeing Krishna not so much as the King of Kings. Of course, in Vaikunthi, he's the King of Kings. But as a supreme enjoyer. Kings have a lot of responsibility and princes just get to have fun. So Balaram's not speaking on his own authority here. He's speaking on the authority of King Ugrasena. King Ugrasena has said, even though, now this is the only thing Balaram says. This all he says is this one verse. Even though by irreligious means, several of you defeated a single opponent who follows the religious codes, still, I am tolerating this for the sake of unity among family members. Now, see how diplomatic Balaram is here. He says, Ugrasena is saying this, I'm not saying this. And, you know, you guys made a mistake. You were irreligious. Samba didn't do anything wrong. Kshatriya has kidnapped their brides lots of times. It's common practice. He was following religious codes. You guys were irreligious. But we're not going to do anything to you because we're all family. And we're just going to tolerate it. So he was very indirect. He didn't say, hey, give Samba, right? He didn't come out and chastise them directly, very subtly. So this is also a nice lesson whenever we're in a position to correct somebody, your Balaram's God. But still he's doing it in a very delicate way. And we find, we should remember as we're going through these leelas, that Balaram is the original guru. And Srila Prabhupada said that guru is not a particular man, guru is a truth. So that doesn't mean we have no allegiance to the particular jiva who comes as guru, or particular jivas. who are there as our gurus. But the point is that we're really dealing with Balaram. Guru is representative of Balaram, or sometimes said the representative of Srimati Radharani. And Balaram is always working for our benefit. Guru is always working for our benefit. So we will find, if we examine our life, that the Supreme Lord and Guru, they're always going to deal with us very gently first. You know, Krishna was ready to come in and have a war. All the Rishis had their armor on. But Balaram, as the Supreme Guru, says, no. Don't fight. Gentle. And he comes in gently. Hey, you know, you guys were irreligious, but we're not going to do anything. And if you examine your life, you'll always find that it's always gentle first. It's always gentle first. Especially Guru. Especially the sadhus. Their dealings with us are always very gentle. So we say sadhu is one who cuts. He doesn't cut first. He doesn't cut first. It's kind of like if you go to see a doctor and the doctor says first to you, you know, you need to get some more exercise. You need to stop smoking like that. And only after a while does the doctor say, okay, we've got to cut. Right? So Balaram is the Supreme Guru. He doesn't come in cutting. Unfortunately, the Kurus don't respond rightly to this very kind, benevolent, gentle behavior of Lord Balaram. And this again is very much a symptom of the age of quarrel, that we're all defending our pride and our false ego, which is what we're supposed to be destroying, yes? Have everybody come here to destroy their... Who's come here to destroy their false ego? All right, well, why are we defending it with swords and knives and guns then? You know, it's rather silly. So that's what these gurus do. You know, Balaram walks up to you and says, you did something wrong. That's okay, it's all right. You know, I love you, your family, I'm not going to punish you, but you did something wrong. And what are you supposed to, how are you supposed to respond? Oh, okay, I'm sorry, how can I fix it? Right, and guru isn't just the person who initiates us or the person who put on a seat in worship. Guru is speaking to everybody, my dear friends. Right, is Krishna in everybody's heart? We're not supposed to deal with pride and arrogance towards anybody. When my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, was in the hospital after having had a stroke, so the doctor comes in and he said, this old man's praying too much, he should get some exercise. And there was a disciple there who got very offended. He said, you can't speak to my spiritual master like that. And Srila Prabhupada said, no, he's right. And after that, Prabhupada started taking an hour, hour and a half morning walk every day. He didn't say, how dare you instruct me? Right? So the crews really, they didn't handle this very well. Upon hearing these words of Lord Baladev's, which were full of potency, courage, and strength. So had they taken these words full of potency, courage, and strength, they would have been filled with potency, courage, and strength. And were appropriate to his transcendental power. The Kauravas became furious and spoke as follows. So this is again the natural reaction of a conditioned soul. How dare you? Now, they really dig themselves into a pit here. And this is also what we do when our false ego is attacked. When our false ego is attacked, instead of just saying, oh, okay, I don't want to keep my pride anyway. I've taken up this process to get rid of my false ego. Thank you very much for helping me. Instead of that, we not only do we defend our own false ego, our nemesis, but we end up attacking the other person. So the Kurus don't just defend themselves and their own pride, but they attack Balaram and the Vishnus. The Kuru noble said, oh, how amazing this is. The force of time is indeed insurmountable. In other words, okay, Kali's come. You're acting on the influence of Kali. A lowly shoe now wants to climb on the head that bears the royal crown. It is because these Rishnis are bound to us by marital ties that we have granted them equality, allowing them to share our beds, seats, and meals. Indeed, it is we who have given them their royal thrones. Bad move. Who gives us everything? It's Krishna, it's Brahma. And they're thinking, we've given to them. We're so kind, you know. Again, we think of this. We're so kind. We built a temple for God. We built it all. We've done so much for Krishna. You think like that? I've done so much for Krishna. He's not treating me nicely. Only because we look the other way could they enjoy the pair of yak-tail fans and the conch shell, the white umbrella throne and royal bed. Again, they're saying the yadu's not supposed to rule, but we let them have all the royal symbols because we just looked the other way and said, well, they are married into our family. No longer should the yadus be allowed to use these royal symbols, which now cause trouble for those who gave them, like milk fed to poisonous snakes. Whoa. Having prospered by our grace, these yadavas have now lost all shame and are daring to command us. How would even Indra dare usurp anything that Bhishma, Drona, Arjuna, or the other Kurus have not given him? It would be like a lamb claiming the lion's kill. Really dumb. Yeah, but again, this is our tendency in the age of Kali. As soon as someone says, excuse me, you've done something wrong, we go, I've done something wrong? Look at you. You're like this, and 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 I'm actually wonderful, and you're actually horrible, and the only reason that I have anything to do with you is because of my mercy and my grace. Sri Badarayani said, O best of the Bharatas, after the arrogant Kurus, thoroughly puffed up by the opulence of their high birth and relations, had spoken these harsh words to Lord Balaram, they turned and went back into their seat. Seeing the bad behavior of the Kurus and hearing their nasty words, the infallible Lord Balaram became filled with rage. His countenance frightful to behold, he laughed repeatedly and spoke as follows. So again, this anger is beneficial. It's loving. Balaram's mood is always loving. It's always caring. And everything he's doing and every way he's dealing with us is always caring. Lord Balaram said, clearly the many passions of these scoundrels have made them so proud that they do not want peace. And that's what we have to ask ourselves when we're defending the very thing that we come to destroy, our false ego. Do we want peace? Do we want to be right? Do we want to be honored? Or do we want peace? Then let them be pacified by physical punishment as animals are with a stick. So when we're not open to the gentle voice of Guru, to the gentle voice of the Lord, then, well, the next thing is the stick. As I said to a very good friend of mine, so Krishna calls the cows with the flute, the rope, and the stick. So what do you want to come for? He's always going to use his flute first, then the rope, then the stick. He never pulls out the stick first. We were meditating in the morning, a couple verses on Bhaktivinoda Thakura Sharanagati, where it's really interesting. He writes a prayer talking about himself as a gopi, as a Manjari gopi who's maintained by his gopi leader. But right before that, he has this prayer about Amun Krishna's cows. A really sweet prayer. It says, I'm one of Krishna's cows. I know I'm in the mood of your cow. And when we go to drink the poison water of the Jamuna, I know you're going to save me. When Lord Brahma kidnaps me, I know you're going to rescue me. When we all go in Agastya's mouth, I know you will save me. You are my protector. All right? So it's not that ontologically he's a cow, but in that he's in that mood that I'm surrendered to, just like one of your little calves and cows. So we should think like that. I'm one of Krishna's little beloved calves and cows. He's going to call me with his sweet flute. Let me come then. Let him not have to take out the rope and the stick. So Balaram is here saying, I tried to be nice, but they don't want peace. Okay, I've got to pull out the stick. Only gradually was I able to calm the furious yadus and Lord Krishna, who is also enraged. So this guru, this is our bridge. How are we going to get the mercy of Krishna without Guru? I mean, if we're honest, we've committed so many sins. We've harmed so many living entities in this life and in previous lives. And Krishna has every right by the laws of justice to punish us severely, if we're honest with ourselves, isn't it? Anybody here go a whole week without causing anxiety with another living entity? Anybody want to raise their hand? Do we go a whole week without doing something selfish or something that we know is harmful to ourselves or others? And Krishna is legitimate. But Guru is saying, please, be kind. Don't have a war. Yeah, I know you've already put on your armor. Take it off. We see this with Lord Nityananda and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Jagai and Mada. No, don't hurt them. Forgive them. This is the mood of Balaram. He's saying these foolish gurus. They didn't know that I was stopping even Krishna. Desiring peace for the Kauravas, I came here. But they are so dull-headed, fond of quarrel, and mischievous by nature that they have repeatedly disrespected me. Out of conceit, they dare to address me with harsh words. King Ugrasena, the lord of the Bhojas, Vrishnis, and Andikas, is not fit to command when Indra and other planetary rulers obey his orders? That same Krishna, who occupies the Sudharma assembly hall, and for his enjoyment took the Parijata tree from the immortal demigods, that very Krishna is indeed not fit to sit on the royal throne? The goddess of fortune herself, the ruler of the entire universe, worships his feet, and the master of the goddess of fortune does not deserve the paraphernalia of a mortal king? The dust of Krishna's lotus feet, which is the source of holiness for all places of pilgrimage, is worshipped by the great demigods. The principal deities of all planets are engaged in his service, and they consider themselves most fortunate to take the dust of the lotus feet of Krishna on their crowns. Great demigods like Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and even the goddess of fortune and I are simply parts of his spiritual identity, and we also carefully carry that dust on our head. And still, Krishna is not fit to use the royal insignia or even sit on the royal throne? We Rishis enjoy whatever small parcel of land the Kurus allow us, and we are indeed shoes, whereas the Kurus are the head? So we are trying to go to an intimate relationship with Krishna, isn't it? Isn't that our goal? But we cannot treat Krishna with disrespect. We teach Krishna with disrespect, then we will be reminded, hey, he's God. When Madhyasoda is tying up Krishna, when Radharani is saying, Krishna, you can't come into Kunja today, there's no disrespect. There's no ordinary pride. There's no ahankar. It's all love. And we should not think that because we are aiming for an intimate relationship in Vrajdam, that therefore we can be disrespectful. That we can deride the position of God. Otherwise, a guru will become angry. And he'll say, what are you doing? Therefore, we find that although Krishna is very soft, that the Dham is guarded. The Dham is guarded by Shiva. It's described in the Brahma Samhita, the Goloka Dham is guarded in the 10 directions by tridents. So although we are aiming for intimacy, it cannot be with ahankar. There cannot be any mood that I am great. There must be humility and there must be respect. Just see how these puffed up gurus are intoxicating with their so-called power like ordinary drunken men. What actual ruler with the power command would tolerate their foolish, nasty words? Today I shall rid the earth of the Kauravas, declared the furious Balaram. Thus he took his plow weapon and rose up as if to set the three worlds ablaze. Now remember that Balaram is also an Antasesha. And it's described in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam that the Lord creates the material world to give the conditioned souls a chance to regain their Krishna consciousness. But periodically he gets disgusted and said, let's close down the whole show. Right? You ever deal with something like that? You give him a chance, you give him a chance, give him a chance, give him a chance, give him a chance, give him a chance. And then you say, all right, enough is enough. So Balaram as Ananta also does that. Periodically he says, enough is enough. And he burns the whole place down. Then after a while he says, okay, let's try again. So the Lord angrily dug up Hastinapur with the tip of his plow and began to drag it, intending to cast the entire city in the Ganges. So Srila Prabhupada says that this Balaram looked like he was about to destroy the creation. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments that Balaram had instructed the Ganga, destroy everyone except Sambha. So there you are, you're one of the crews. We show that Balaram, and you're back in the city, and all of a sudden you feel an
earthquake.
And you know it's not coincidence. Not like the modern scientists say, well, it's just the plates of the earth rubbing against each other or some, you know, things like that. Seeing that their city was tumbling about like a raft at sea, imagine what was going on in Hastinapur. As it was being dragged away, and that it was about to fall into the Ganges, the Kauravas became terrified. To save their lives, they approached the Lord for shelter, taking their families with them. Placing Sambha and Lakshman in front, they joined their palms in supplication. So better late than never. So if at least we can surrender to Krishna when he pulls out his stick, you know, better late than never. Best with the flute, better with the rope, but at least if you can do it with the stick. And you find, like, Ravana doesn't even do it then, right? Like, you know, the Ramayana, so Ravana, his brother Kumbhakarna gets killed, his son Indrajit gets killed, all of his sons and brothers, they're all dead, everything's crumbling around him, and he never surrenders, he never gets it together, he never says, oh, I should surrender, or Kamsa like that, he sends all these demons, and Krishna kills all of them, and he doesn't figure it out, and Krishna kills Kubalaya Pita, and he breaks the bow, that, you know, and he still doesn't, like, get it. And Krishna kills the wrestlers. At any point, Kamsa could have said, I surrender. But he never, doesn't figure it out. So let's not be like that. At a certain point, at least, let's say, okay, I surrender. And as soon as the living entity surrenders, immediately, because Krishna's a father, Balaram's a father. He doesn't have any enmity. He's always the benefactor. The Kauravas said, oh, Rama, Rama, foundation of everything. We know nothing of your power. Please excuse our offense, or we are ignorant and misguided. Now, they should have said that in the first place. So that should be our first response. I'm going to tell you all a secret. You never lose anything by saying you're a fool. We're so terrified to say we're a fool. You know, anybody here willing to say they're not a fool? How silly. Aren't we all fools? Am I the only fool in the room?
Yes.
It just doesn't, you don't lose anything. Maybe occasionally, there might be some occasional times where you can't do that. Maybe some occasional political situations where you can't do that. But generally speaking, like Narada told the snake, you can put your hood up sometimes. So that may be sometimes. But generally speaking, it just doesn't hurt to just say, yeah, I'm a fool, I'm wrong. Instead of waiting until your whole life is going up and down like a raft at sea, and everything's going to be destroyed, and then, oh, I'm a fool! Yeah, okay! You alone cause the creation, maintenance, and annihilation of the cosmos, and of you there is no prior cause. Indeed, O Lord, authorities say that the worlds are mere playthings for you as you perform your pastimes. O unlimited one of a thousand heads, as your pastime you carry the earthly globe upon one of your heads. So it's said that Balaram has carrying the whole universe even on his head, just like a little mustard seed. So if you took a little tiny mustard seed and put it on your head, you wouldn't even know it was there. I want to speak of the planets. The planets are said, the attractive quality, the gravity is actually the power of Balaram. He doesn't even notice he's carrying the planet around. At the time of annihilation, you withdraw the entire universe within your body and remain all alone, lying down to rest. Now here's the key verse, which is text 47. Your anger is meant for instructing everyone. It is not a manifestation of hatred or envy. So in our life, when we don't listen to the whispers and we don't listen to the flute, we get the stick, huh? You sometimes get that? Yes? I'm not the only one again? Yes? But we should never think that God hates me or he's envious of me. But the Lord never desires harm for us. Just like sometimes a loving parent has to get angry at the child. Don't run in the street! You can't always just say, oh, don't run in the street. But even when we're punished, there's no hatred. There is no envy. So this is true for God, and again, Balaram is the guru principle. It's also true for Guru. Guru says heavy things. Guru is heavy. Yes? And Guru may say heavy things to us personally, or heavy things in general. Heavy things. Shastra is full of heavy things. Cutting. That's what we want. Our false ego is killing us, destroying us, causing us so much suffering. And sometimes heavy things are required. But those are not out of hatred or envy. O Supreme Lord, you sustain the pure mode of goodness, and you become angry only to maintain and protect the world. We bow down to you, O soul of all beings, O wielder of all potencies, O tireless maker of the universe. Offering your obeisances, we take shelter of you. Sukadeva Goswami said, thus propitiated by the crews, whose city was trembling and who was surrendering to him in great distress, Lord Balaram became very calm and kindly disposed toward them. Do not be afraid, he said. And he took away their fear. As soon as we surrender, we have no fear. All of our fear is caused by trying to hold on to and protect our false ego, which is not ourself anyway, and which is a lie. The false ego, I am great, I am powerful, I am perfect, I am wonderful, I am the smartest, I am the most beautiful, I am the most this. It's all a bunch of nonsense. And all of our fear comes from holding on to this false persona that we know is not us, and we know that we cannot properly maintain it because it's not us. We're always going around thinking, is anybody going to break through my false ego and see what I really am? That's what our fear is coming from. And when we allow Guru and Krishna to say, let's go to this thing, then all of our fear is taken away. Duryodhana, being very affectionate to his daughter, gave her as her dowry. How would you guys like to get this as your inheritance? 1,260-year-old elephants, 120,000 horses, 6,000 golden chariots, 6,000 golden chariots. I mean, not just like the car. You know, maybe your dad gives you a car. When I was 17, my dad gave me a car. Gave me a Volvo sports car. But it wasn't made of gold. 6,000 golden chariots shining like the sun, and 1,000 maidservants with jeweled lockets on their necks. So not just, even the maidservants were wearing real gems, right? Now even the wives are wearing plastic, but the maidservants are wearing gems. The Supreme Lord, Chief of the Yadus, accepted all these gifts and then departed with his son and daughter-in-law. So here, Samba is referred to as Balaram's son, although he's actually the son of Krishna, his nephew, as his well-wishers bid him farewell. So again, they're realizing he's our well-wisher. Then Lord Halayuda entered his city of Dwarka and met his relatives, whose hearts were all bound to him in loving attachment. In the assembly hall, he reported to the Yadu leaders everything about his dealings with the Kurus. Even today, the city of Hastinapur is visibly elevated on its southern side along the Ganges, thus showing the signs of Lord Balaram's love. Balaram Ki! Balaram Ki! Balaram Ki! Isn't it wonderful, a personal philosophy of God? Such wonderful philosophy. So now we will worship the Supreme Lord. Jai.
Thank you very much.